do solemnly swear.
I, Harry S. Truman, do solemnly swear.
I, Dwight D. Eisenhower, do solemnly swear.
I, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear.
I, Lyndon Baines Johnson, do solemnly swear.
I, Richard Bill House Nixon, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office
of the Presidency of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability,
preserve, protect, and defend
the Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
From George Washington to Richard Nixon, the 37 presidents in the history of the United States have sworn to that oath symbolic of the nation's highest office. We shall hear six of those presidents, the 32nd through the 37th, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and Richard Nixon, voicing their views of the awesome, exalted, at times perhaps wretched office they held. First, a sound capsule of four decades of recent history in the words of these six presidents, words which give definition to our times and to our lives.
This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny.
I see one third of a nation ill housed, ill clad, ill nourished.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
America hates war.
Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign war.
We must be the great arsenal of democracy.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
We look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms.
We shall not settle for less than total victory.
I only wish that Franklin D. Roosevelt had lived to witness this day. The forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe.
An American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy.
The Charter of the United Nations, which you are now signing.
The Cold War began to overshadow our lives.
I'm Harry S. Truman. I work for the government, and I'm trying to keep my job. We're out to win this election, and we're going to do that on the second day of November.
McCarthyism, the corruption of truth, the abandonment of our historical devotion to fair play.
Federal fair employment legislation with enforcement power is greatly needed, and it ought to be on the books, and I'm going to keep fighting for it, come hell or high water.
If we let the Republic of Korea go under, some other country would be next.
I accept your summons. I will lead this crusade.
I shall go to Korea.
Forces of good and evil are masked and armed and opposed, as rarely before in history.
An armistice was signed almost an hour ago in Korea.
This struggle we now are in, we call the Cold War.
This is light against dark, freedom against slavery. It is godliness against atheism.
Don't join the book burners.
We and other nations have a great responsibility to promote the peaceful use of space.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence by the military-industrial complex.
If Indochina goes, several things happen right away.
We stand today on the edge of a new frontier.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
This was a struggle of Cuban patriots against a Cuban dictator.
All this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated.
I believe we should go to the moon.
I have today signed an executive order providing for the establishment of a Peace Corps.
It's their war. We can help them, but they have to win it, the people of Vietnam against the communists.
A great leader is dead. A great nation must move on.
We have the opportunity to move not only toward the rich society and the powerful society, but upward to the great society.
This administration has declared unconditional war on poverty.
Today,
we begin to be masters of our environment.
We are sometimes forced by an adversary to back our beliefs with steel, just as Lincoln did.
We will not be defeated.
The looting and arson and plunder and pillage which have occurred are not part of a civil rights protest.
Tonight, I have ordered our aircraft and our naval vessels to make no attacks on North Vietnam.
I shall not see, and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
In the orderly transfer of power, we celebrate the unity that keeps us free. After a period of confrontation, we are entering an era of negotiation.
The killing in this tragic war must stop. We shall do whatever is required to safeguard American lives and American honor.
And so tonight, to you, the great silent majority of my fellow Americans, I ask for your support.
I am today ordering a freeze on all prices and wages throughout the United States for a period of 90 days.
Our goal is something Americans have not enjoyed in this century, a full generation of peace.
The meeting between the leaders of China and the United States is to seek the normalization of relations between the two countries.
The United States and the Soviet Union are on the threshold of a new relationship.
A lot of history is determined by the one man who occupies the office of President of the United States. What manner of power resides there? Let us look into this first office of the land through the eyes of the six men who have last held this position. This is a profile of the presidency, drawn in the words of the men who have been president. First, some general impressions. Harry Truman.
White House, a very pleasant place to live. But it's just like living behind an iron fence or behind bars, really. I used to call it the Great White Jail.
Dwight Eisenhower.
It is truly, I think, the most powerful position in the free world.
John Kennedy.
I would say that the problems are more difficult than I imagined them to be. The responsibilities placed on the United States are greater than I imagined them to be. And there are greater limitations upon our ability to bring about a favorable result than I had imagined them to be.
A similar view, Richard Nixon.
When you come into office, the presidency, one has ideas as to what he can accomplish. And he believes he can accomplish a great deal, even though he may have a Congress that is not part of his own party. And then after he gets in, he finds that what he had hoped in terms of achieving goals will not be as great as the actual performance turns out to be.
Lyndon Johnson.
I've watched it since Mr. Hoover's days, and I realized the responsibilities it carried and the obligations of leadership that were there and the decisions that had to be made and the awesome responsibilities of the office. Thomas Jefferson said the second office of the land was an honorable and easy one. The presidency was a splendid misery.
Once more, Richard Nixon.
Theodore Roosevelt called the presidency a bully pulpit. Franklin Roosevelt called it preeminently a place of moral leadership. And surely one of a president's greatest resources is the moral authority of his office.
And again, Harry Truman.
I've made the statement many a time that there are about 15 million people in the country that can afford to have a representative in Washington to look after their interests in addition to the congressmen and senators that they have there, and they're called lobbyists. There's nothing wrong with them. They have perfect right to do that, but there are 150 million people that can't afford that. They have but one man in the government to look after their interests, and that's the President of the United States. He's the lobbyist for 150 million people, and when he ceases to be that, those people are in a pretty bad way so far as the government of the United States is concerned.
The presidency, a splendid misery? The president, a lobbyist for all the people? The interpretations of the office have varied virtually with each office holder. The founding fathers created the presidency as one of the three divisions of federal power within the framework of the Constitution. One observation of that arrangement from President Dwight Eisenhower made shortly after leaving office.
The president, by the Constitution, is the head of the executive branch. It is his duty to execute the laws of the land. They're passed by Congress. They're interpreted by the law, by the judges and the Supreme Courts. But the president is the one that has to execute them. And in an extreme case, he can even call upon the armed forces, as I did in Little Rock, not to to participate in the struggles that were going on then between those who were for integration and those who were not, but to make certain that no organized or unorganized resistance in any place could interfere with the carrying out of the proper orders of a federal judge.
President Franklin Roosevelt visualized himself one member of a three-horse team representing the American form of government. Roosevelt developed this analogy in a radio address in which he scolded the Supreme Court for opposing some of the sweeping changes advocated in the president's New Deal.
Last Thursday, I described the American form of government as a three-horse team provided by the Constitution to the American people so that their field might be plowed. The three horses are, of course, the three branches of government, the Congress, the executive, and the court. Two of the horses, the Congress and the executive, are pulling in unison today. The third is not. Those who have intimated that the President of the United States is trying to drive that team overlook the simple fact that the president as chief executive is himself one of the three horses. It is the American people themselves who are in the driver's seat. It is the American people themselves who want the furrow plowed.
While Roosevelt saw the president's role as workhorse, Eisenhower compared it to being a mountain sheep. The 34th president made that observation in a 1961 interview as he described the many demands of the office.
The president has to be concerned with everything that happens to any human in the United States and often abroad. He, therefore, has visitors who come into his office who jump from, let's say, a discussion of the situation in Laos, and the next one may come in and introduce the teacher of the year. Then comes maybe a half a dozen boys of the explorer movement in the Boy Scouts, so that one of the things about the presidency is the way you have to be prepared to jump just like a mountain sheep from one jag to another jag, and you're always on the alert. You have to be.
Another expression of presidential duties, 1937, a fireside chat to the nation, Franklin Roosevelt.
Anyone charged with proposing or judging national policies should have first-hand knowledge of the nation as a whole. That is why, again this year, I have taken trips to all parts of the country. For a president especially, it is a duty to think in national terms. He must think not only of this year, but of future years when someone else will be president. He must not let the country be deceived by a merely temporary prosperity, which depends on wasteful exploitation of resources which cannot last. He must think not only of keeping us out of war today, but also of keeping us out of war in generations to come.
The president's hardest task? This is how Lyndon Johnson defined it in an address to Congress.
Many of you in this chamber are among my oldest friends. We have shared many happy moments and many hours of work. And we've watched many presidents together. Yet, only in the White House can you finally know the full weight of this office. The greatest burden is not running the huge operations of government, are meeting daily troubles, large and small, or even working with the Congress. A president's hardest task is not to do what is right, but to know what is right. Yet the presidency brings no special gift of prophecy or foresight. You take an oath, you step into an office, and you must then help guide a great democracy.
The powers of the presidency, as defined in the Constitution, are broadly stated. John Quincy Adams, the sixth man to be president, said after leaving office, "I found no article in the Constitution of the United States delegating the right to define or limit what are or are not the constitutional powers of the president." That situation has led to some conflicting interpretations. For example, Section 2 of Article 2 of the Constitution states, "The president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states." This presidential mandate to be commander-in-chief has been widely interpreted to include all powers which may be necessary to wage war. Yet the same Constitution stipulates that only Congress shall have the power to declare war. During the past two decades, hundreds of thousands of Americans have been involved in military actions, most notably in Korea and Indochina, without any formal declaration of war by Congress. There are those who argue that this is in violation of the checks and balance system which the Founding Fathers had built into the Constitution. President Eisenhower touched on this issue in an interview in which he appraised presidential powers to deal with Cold War problems.
Now, when we've been in real emergencies, that is the acute emergencies of war, almost automatically, the president has to assume powers that otherwise he would never attempt to exercise. Sometimes these powers are given specifically by the Congress, but often they are not. For example, recognizing that the Cold War sometimes heats up to the point almost of a direct crisis, we have the cases of Formosa and the Mideast. In both these cases, I went to the Congress and asked for their specific authority to take certain action under certain conditions. Now, this meant, by and large, that under those conditions, our armed forces would be at war. In other words, Congress gave to the president almost the power of declaring war, but under a given set of conditions.
The Cold War turned into a killing war in Indochina during the Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon administrations. Lyndon Johnson secured authority to wage this war in a congressional resolution which was prompted by events later disputed. Here is one Johnson statement on his power as commander-in-chief.
"The President of the United States is not about to commit forces and undertake actions to deter aggression in South Vietnam, to prevent this communist conspiracy, unless and until the American people through their Congress sign on to go in. If the president's going in, as he may be required to do, he wants the Congress to go in right by the side of him."
When, in 1970, American troops fighting in Vietnam were ordered into neighboring Cambodia, President Nixon explained why he had not first sought congressional authority for this action.
"Why didn't I go to the Senate, for example, and the House, and ask for their approval? Well, now let us suppose we'd done that. Let's suppose it had taken 7 weeks. What would have happened? Well, first, all of this year's supply of ammunition that we'd acquired would have been gone out of the sanctuaries. Or, even worse, what might have happened is that the rather fearsome defensive barricades that they had in these sanctuaries would have been ready for us, and we would have lost not just 330 men. That's too many to lose in 2 months, and that's all we lost in Cambodia. We'd have lost 3,000, 4,000. Now, as far as I'm concerned, I had to think of what was right and what was necessary, what would save American men, and the element of surprise was important. Now, let me also add this. If this had been what some thought it was, an attempt to expand the war into Cambodia, to launch a war into Cambodia, then of course I would have gone to the Senate, because I think we need congressional support for our actions.
Besides being commander-in-chief, the president is granted a number of other powers under the Constitution. Listing some of them and giving his own unique interpretation to them is the 33rd president, Harry Truman.
He is the foreign policy maker of the nation. He negotiates treaties and he appoints ambassadors and receives and approves them from foreign nations. A most important job, because that means either peace in the world or no peace in the world. No one really appreciates that the Constitution provides that the president shall negotiate treaties, that the president shall appoint ambassadors to foreign countries, that the president shall receive ambassadors from foreign countries, and he doesn't have to receive them unless he wants to. And I'll tell you, I've received a number that I wish I hadn't. But it has to be done, and it can't be helped. And every time the president makes a remark about the relationship between any country and the United States, that remark is of world note and of vital importance.
President Truman neglected to point out that the presidential power to make treaties and appoint ambassadors is somewhat curtailed. The Constitution states that the president shall have power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided two-thirds of the senators present concur, and he shall nominate and, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, with the advice and consent of the Senate. Another of the checks and balances between the branches of government built into the Constitution. Sometimes this leads to friction, as we shall later hear. First, another of the presidential powers elaborated on by President Truman.
The president is also the social head of the state. And this is what a great many of the stuffed shirt people like very much. They think it's just the finest thing in the world to be able to meet counts and princes and queens and kings and things of that kind. And the president, when they come to the United States, is their host. And he always is a courteous host. That's part of the international relationship. He receives and entertains high-ranking visitors as well as ambassadors of foreign nations. And that's a very important job in itself. He gives five or six state dinners to the White House and holds long line receptions. And if you don't think it's a lot of fun to stand in line, shake hands with 2,700 people whose names you can't understand when they're pronounced, just try it once and see what you think. He holds these receptions for the ambassadors who are sent to Washington. He holds a reception for the Congress. He holds a reception for the Supreme Court. And he holds various other receptions. And I want to say to you that the wife of the president has a tremendous burden. She has to receive all the visiting ladies, like the damn Daniel Rao, the DARs, they call themselves. And all the other people who come to Washington for that purpose. The last year we were in the White House, Mrs. Truman, by count, shook hands with 50,000 people. I shook hands with 25,000, but I dodged half of them, and she had to go ahead and do the job. That is a most important part of the president's office, is the social end of it.
But there are also moments of terrifying responsibility in being President of the United States, as we shall hear on side two of this profile of the presidency. If the presidency, in Eisenhower's words, is the most powerful position in the free world, it is also the most awesome. The president has the power of life and death, of peace. peace or war. Indeed, in this nuclear age, the power of possible annihilation of all life on Earth. The president must live with that knowledge as he wrestles with the countless other matters which call for his decision. As Harry Truman said of his office, the buck stops here. Presidents Kennedy and Eisenhower have stated it in different terms.
It's much easier to make the speeches than it is to finally make the judgments, because unfortunately your advisors are frequently divided. If you take the wrong course, and on occasion I have, the president bears the burden, responsibility quite rightly, the advisors may move on to new advice.
The president is responsible. I don't care. The president can be sitting in the White House. He can take his advice from his youngest child. He can go to anywhere in the United States and get advice. But nothing in this earth can take away from him the fixed responsibility he must make the decision.
Well, you know, that old story about Abraham Lincoln in the cabinet. He says, all in favor say aye, and the whole cabinet voted aye, and all opposed no, and Lincoln voted no, and he said the vote is no. So that naturally the Constitution places the responsibility on the president. The other point is something that President Eisenhower said to me. He said, there are no easy matters will ever come to you as president. If they're easy, they will be settled at a lower level. So the matters that finally come to you as president are always the difficult matters, or matters which carry with them large implications.
The difficult matters can come upon the president at any time, any place. Lyndon Johnson, after leaving office, recalled some of the horrors of hell that invaded his nights in the White House.
I said to someone the other day that one of the things I enjoyed most was being able to go to bed after the 10 o'clock news at night and to sleep until daylight the next morning. I don't remember ever having an experience like that in the 5 years I was in the White House. The real horror was to be sleeping soundly about 3:30 or 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and have the telephone ring and the operator say, sorry to wake you, Mr. President. There's just a second between the time the operator got me on the line until she could get Mr. Rostow in the situation room or Mr. Bundy in the situation room. And you went through the horrors of hell. Had we hit a Russian ship? Had an accident occurred? Did we have another Pueblo? Someone made a mistake? Were we at war? Well, those experiences are gone. You say, don't you miss them? Sure you miss them. I really never did want those calls to begin with. I would have liked to have missed them when I was there.
This is Truman's view of the presidential decision-making process.
All my life, whenever it comes time to make a decision, I make it and forget about it and go to work on something else. And when these things came before me as President of the United States, I made the decision on them and went into the next thing. You never have time to stop. You've got to keep going because there's always a decision just ahead of you that you've got to make. And you don't want to look back. If you make a mistake in one of those decisions, correct it by another decision and go ahead.
Truman had a number of major decisions to make. The use of the newly developed atom bomb in the closing days of World War II, the development of the hydrogen bomb, the emerging Cold War with the Soviet Union, the hot war in Korea. In a 1958 interview, Truman was asked which had been his toughest decision.
The most difficult decision I had to make while I was novice was Korea.
Any regrets?
Not the slightest. Not the slightest in the world. The reason that I was able to make the Korean decision, I remembered Munich and the League of Nations, and we had just established the United Nations. The United Nations passed a resolution which had recognized the Republic of Korea, and it had been established. And when the Republic of Korea was about to be overcome by aggression started by the communists, backed by Russia and what later became communist China, it seemed to me that the proper thing was to establish the United Nations as a going concern, and that's what I tried to do. But that was the most difficult decision I had to make during my whole administration of 8 years.
One of the major decisions of Kennedy's administration was to confront the Soviet Union over the presence of Russian rockets in Cuba, the Cuban Missile Crisis. The president announced a series of actions, including a blockade against Soviet ships headed for Cuba. The world seemingly teetered on the brink of war and then regained its balance. Here a recollection of how that decision came to be made.
The most recent one was hammered out, really, our policy and decision over a period of 5 or 6 days. During that period, the 15 people, more or less, who were directly consulted, frequently changed their view because whatever action we took had so many disadvantages to it. And each action that we took raised the prospect that it might escalate with the Soviet Union into a nuclear war. Finally, however, I think a general consensus developed and certainly seemed after all alternatives were examined that the course of action that we finally adopted was the right one. Now, when I talked to members of the Congress, several of them suggested we confronted them on that Monday with the evidence. My feeling is that if they had gone through the 5-day period we had gone through it, looking at the various alternatives, the advantages and disadvantages of action, they probably would have come out the same way that we did. I think we took the right one.
The president is at once the leader of the government and the leader of his political party. Frequently, the two functions overlap. Occasionally, they conflict. One area centers on the president's powers of appointment, particularly judicial appointments, with the advice and consent of the Senate. Some observations by President Nixon.
During a 4-year term, the president of the United States, sitting at this desk in this historic room, makes over 3,000 major appointments to various government positions. By far, the most important appointments he makes are those to the Supreme Court of the United States. Presidents come and go, but the Supreme Court, through its decision, goes on forever. These are the criteria I believe should be applied in naming people to the Supreme Court. First, the Supreme Court is the highest judicial body in this country. Its members, above all, be among the very best lawyers in the nation. The second consideration is the judicial philosophy of those who are to serve in the court. Now, I emphasize the word judicial because whether an individual is a Democrat or Republican cannot and should not be a decisive factor in determining whether he should be on the court. By judicial philosophy, I do not mean agreeing with the president on every issue. It would be a total repudiation of our constitutional system if judges on the Supreme Court, or any other federal court, for that matter, were like puppets on a string pulled by the president who appointed them. When I appointed Chief Justice Burger, I told him that from the day he was confirmed by the Senate, he could expect that I would never talk to him about a case that was before the court. In the case of both Chief Justice Burger and Mr. Justice Blackmun, and in the case of the two nominees that I shall be sending to the Senate tomorrow, their sole obligation is to the Constitution and to the American people, and not to the president who appointed them to their positions.
The relationship between the three branches of the federal government, the presidency, the Congress, and the courts, has been marked by periodic dissensions, by fears founded or unfounded, that one branch is trying to encroach upon the authority of another. It is out of these clashes that their powers have evolved and continue to evolve. A president, confronted by an opposition Congress, can often be stymied in the enactment of his legislative programs. President Roosevelt, in his first administration, however, had a Congress apparently eager to do his bidding. As a result, numerous programs were passed, and Congress got a thank you from the president.
In the many methods of attack with which we met those problems, you and I, by mutual understanding and by determination to cooperate, helped to make democracy succeed by refusing to permit unnecessary disagreement to arise between our two branches of our government. I look forward to a continuance of that cooperation in the next 4 years. I look forward also to the continuance of the basis of that, a mutual respect for each other's proper sphere of functioning. In a democracy which is working well and a common sense realization of the need for play in the joints of the machine.
Republican President Eisenhower had a more difficult time securing the passage of legislation. He was thwarted by an opposition Congress.
If you had a Congress like that of Mr. Roosevelt's in the early years of his administrations, Congress was quite ready to go along with everything he wanted to do. The country was in an emergency, and they followed along. The first 100 days of his administration, almost fabulous in the amount of legislation was brought about. But even in the first 2 years of my administration, for example, we came into power, the Republicans did, for the first time in 20 years. There was not a single senator, Republican senator, in the Senate when I came in there who had ever served with a Republican president. Now, as a result, they were raised in this tradition of antagonism between the executive and the legislature. And it was very, very difficult for Republican senators at first to remember that their job was now to cooperate with the president and he with them. Contrary, they felt that they had to cut him down at first. It was instinctive. And indeed, the only way I could get anything constructive done in the last 6 years of my 2 terms was to get of Democratic help, or otherwise I couldn't pass anything.
Kennedy, too, commented on relations between President and Congress.
Franklin Roosevelt was elected by the largest majority in history in 1936, and he got his worst defeat a few months afterwards in the Supreme Court bill. So that they are two separate offices and two separate powers, the Congress and the presidency. There's bound to be conflict. But they must cooperate to the degree that's possible. But that's why no president's program is ever put in. The only time a president's program is put in quickly and easily is when the program is insignificant. But if it's significant and affects important interests and is controversial, therefore, then there's a fight, and then the president is never wholly successful.
Harry Truman's relations with Congress, often, in a word, feisty.
The president doesn't have a fight or two with Congress is not considered a very strong man. It's necessary, and it's all right. There's nothing wrong with it. It's not a personal matter. It's a matter of the Congress always trying to infringe the presidential rights. And a good, strong president, the Congress will accuse him of trying to infringe the congressional rights. And in each case, there's always some good accomplished, because the final result will be in the interest of the people. And the fact that we have those division of powers, it makes it much more safe for the people.
According to President Kennedy, the legislative process can also be an obstacle to the safe passage of presidential programs.
The Constitution and the development of the Congress all give advantage to delay. It's very easy to defeat a bill in the Congress. It's much more difficult to pass one. To go through a committee, say the Ways and Means Committee of the House, a subcommittee and get a majority vote, full committee, get a majority vote, go to the Rules Committee and get a rule, go to the floor of the House and get a majority. Start over again in the Senate, the subcommittee and full committee, and in the Senate there is unlimited debate, so you can never bring a matter to a vote if there's enough determination on the part of the opponents, even if they're a minority, to go through the Senate with the bill, and then unanimously get a conference between the House and Senate to adjust the bill, or if one member objects, to have it go back through the Rules Committee, back through the Congress, and have this done on a controversial piece of legislation where powerful groups are opposing it. That's an extremely difficult task.
Because of his power and prominence, the president comes under constant and often harsh scrutiny by the nation's journalists. Following are three views on the relations between the president and the news media.
Oh, well, if he's got a thin skin, he's got no business being in the presidency. He must understand his own ideas of what's right and wrong, act on those ideas, and if the newspapers and the means of communication don't like what he does, let them say what they want to say. And then if he's in the same disposition I am, he'll get up and tell them where they're wrong, and never let them browbeat him.
It's never pleasant to be reading things frequently that are not agreeable news, but I would say that it's an invaluable arm of the presidency as a check, really, on what's going on in administration. And more things come to my attention that cause me either concern or give me information, even though we never like it, and even though we don't have, even though we wish they didn't write it, and even though we disapprove, there isn't any doubt that we couldn't do the job at all in a free society without a very, very active press.
I do not believe that network commentators or newspaper reporters, as distinguished from editorial writers, who of course have a right to every bias and should express such bias, are above criticism. The criticism, and they shouldn't be sensitive about it. Now, when you go, however, to the question of subpoenaing the notes of reporters, when you go to the question of government action, which requires the revealing of sources, then I take a very jaundiced view of that kind of action. I believe, however, that each of us as a public figure has a right to indicate when we think the news coverage has been fair or unfair.
One of the singular and enduring features of America's constitutional democracy has been the orderly transferal of power. 36 different and diverse men have held the reins of power, and each has been like a temporary tenant who moves on when his lease runs out. It has been a hallmark of our system. Lyndon Johnson, who was abruptly thrust into the presidency upon the assassination of John Kennedy, recalls his efforts to assure the nation and the world that the torch had been passed, that the republic endured.
I thought it quite important that I have the cooperation and the assistance of the former presidents, of President Hoover, President Truman, President Eisenhower. I not only had their assistance and cooperation, I had their enthusiastic help. President Eisenhower got in his car and drove down from Gettysburg and sat in my office, borrowed a yellow notepad and a pencil, and sat there for a good while and wrote out his views, his suggestions to a new president. He said, the first man I'd call to Washington is Robert Anderson. He said, the second thing I'd do, I'd work out arrangements with the leadership, have a joint session of the Congress. He said, the next thing I'd do is say to the Congress, we want to take up President Kennedy's program, start with his tax program. And so with that memorandum as a basis, and with some of the suggestions I'd received from President Truman, I tried to pull in all these groups. And I thought that it was a rather formidable bulldozer by the time we got them in and got them in agreement to move forward.
By constitutional amendment, the 22nd, which was proposed in 1947 and ratified in 1951, no person shall be elected to the office of the president more than twice. Previously, there was no restriction on the number of four-year terms. Franklin Roosevelt, for example, was elected to four terms. Harry Truman was excluded from this new limitation, but he didn't think the amendment was a good idea anyway.
It was passed because we were afraid that another Roosevelt would come along in the Democratic Party and that there'd be maybe a three or four term president. They had no fear of me because they didn't think I could be elected in 1948, but they were fooled. And they eliminated me from that amendment. I could be elected as many times as I wanted to for the presidency of the United States under the amendment to the Constitution, but I have no ambition to be president again. I've had all I wanted.
While in the presidency, John Kennedy was asked if he would still favor the constitutional limitation on two terms for a president, which he had done earlier while he was a senator from Massachusetts.
I think 8 years is enough, and I'm not sure that a president, if he's in my case, if I were reelected, that you're at such a disadvantage. There aren't many jobs. That isn't the power of the presidency, patronage at all. That's their field in the first month. Most of those jobs belong to the members of the Congress anyway. So patronage isn't a factor. I think there are many other powers of the presidency that run in the second term as well as the first. The fact is, President Eisenhower has great influence today in the Republican Party and therefore in the country, and has great influence in foreign policy. He doesn't even hold office. In some ways, his influence is greater to some degree. So that, and the same is really true of also of President Truman, President Hoover. I don't think that it depends on the influence of a president. It's still substantial in his second term, though I haven't had a second term. I think it is.
President Kennedy was never to have a second term. The Constitution provides that in the event of death, the vice president assumes the office. He becomes not an acting president, but the president. An observation on that provision for succession from Harry Truman.
And the precedent was set by a man by the name of John Tyler from Virginia. Daniel Webster tried his best to make an acting president out of John Tyler, and John Tyler told him he was the president. And if he didn't believe it, he'd fire him. So Dan had to come around.
The vice presidential nominee should be the second best qualified man in the party?
Yes, I think he ought to be as well qualified as the nominee for president. And I don't think there is any best or second best. A man's either good, bad, or indifferent. And I think the man who's nominated for vice president ought to have the same qualifications as the man who's elected president, because there's no telling. There's only one heartbeat between him and the White House.
How do the recent presidents summarize their feelings about the office they held? None has been as harsh in his judgments as an earlier president, John Quincy Adams, who said, "The four most miserable years of my life were my 4 years in the presidency." John Kennedy, for example, found some satisfactions to that office.
We're all concerned as citizens and as parents and all the rest with all the problems we've been talking about tonight. They're all the problems which, if I wasn't president, I'd be concerned about as a father or as a citizen. So at least you have an opportunity to do something about them. And if what you do is useful and successful, then of course that's great satisfaction.
After leaving the presidency, Lyndon Johnson was asked in an interview if there was anything he missed about the job. Had he enjoyed being president?
Of course I miss, but as I said, the last press conference I had out here, most of it I miss good. President Nixon said to me, how did you feel when you weren't president anymore? And I said, I don't know whether you'll understand this now or not, but you certainly will later. I sat there on that platform and waited for you to stand up and raise your right hand and take the oath of office. And I think the most pleasant words that ever came into my ears was, "So help me God," that you repeated after that oath. Because at that time, I no longer had the fear that I was the man that could make the mistake of involving the world in a war. That I was no longer the man that would have to carry the terrifying responsibility of protecting the lives of this country and maybe the entire world, and unleashing the horrors of some of our great power if I felt that was required.
If the presidency is a terrifying responsibility, it is well to remember that it is we, the people, who select the man to bear it. That, too, is a kind of terrifying responsibility. It is a power to be exercised with the utmost care and concern. Our lives, the course of history, may well depend on the man we choose to be the President of the United States.